Hello and welcome to series two of The Joy of Writing. I'm your host, Mark Carew. In this series, I will be talking to authors about the fun, the satisfaction, the joy they get from their writing, whether it's prose fiction, narrative non-fiction, or poetry. In this episode, I'm intrigued to learn from Ed Parnell, author of Ghostland, how the writing advice he gives to students applies equally to the teacher, and how three books were in particular important to him in his own development. It's always nice to talk to someone who actually teaches the art of writing to students, and you're a writing tutor on a course. I mean, how do you find that? How are your students, and what sort of approach do you take with them?
This is quite a new development for me. It's something I've been doing, teaching a couple of online narrative non-fiction courses since February. So actually the first one I started kicked off, and it had all of these different exercises about going and observing people, sort of having a conversation in a cafe, all this kind of thing. And then within a couple of weeks, all of the coronavirus stuff unfolded. So suddenly I had to rapidly rejig many of the kind of later assignments and things. But it was I guess it came at a good time, because we were all of us then, suddenly there were, I think I had about 13 students on that course and myself, and we were obviously all in various parts of the world as well. There were several students who were kind of a bit ahead of the game in Southeast Asia and various places. So right. They were kind of reporting on lots of kind of toilet roll shortages and things a couple of weeks before the rest of us. And I think at that point, still at that point where we were probably thinking, oh well, that's in Asia, that's, oh, I wonder if that will impact on us in a big way. And then of course, obviously, as things have transpired, that soon was the case. But I think teaching it certainly was good for me at this moment in time, when I perhaps wasn't feeling like I particularly wanted to throw myself into a new kind of creative writing endeavor myself. So actually, yeah, other people's work to look at and give feedback on and to sort of try and help a little bit with, that was a really positive thing actually, and I really enjoyed it. And the same course that came to an end a couple of weeks ago, and I'm now teaching it again with a new set of students. So
what did you learn from that course first time around that you sort of can now deliver to the students on the second time?
One of the things I noticed reading lots of the students' work is that I think as writers, we tend to sometimes forget that the reader isn't privy to all of the knowledge that we're privy to.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff where I'm kind of gently reminding people, look, you may know this fact, but the reader doesn't have a clue about this. And within that, then there was lots of kind of things that came off from that. But actually, I then thought, yeah, I'm not very good at doing that either, and I really need to try, and these lessons that I'm teaching people, they equally apply to me, and I need to think of these, you know, when I start writing my next book, whenever that is, I'm hoping that it will kind of, a lot of these lessons will, I'll remember them as well. So I think that could well be useful. Let's see.
So it's the thing that you can't assume too much knowledge from the reader's part, but also you don't want to sort of spell it out in a great lecture.
Yeah, there's a tightrope to walk, isn't there, I think. Yeah. Although I think sometimes, I suspect, I would err on the side of giving more information than going the other way. Well, at least in non-fiction, I suspect. I think it might maybe a bit different in fiction, because you can do... you're probably doing more, there's more things you might be doing with your plot and kind of withholding and stuff. And obviously you can do those same things in non-fiction, and you probably should be, but you still, even just things like when you're talking about, I don't know, where a town is or something, you might know that that particular town is in Sussex, but again, your reader, you might have a reader somewhere in a different part of the world or a different part of the country who doesn't know where that particular place is, and it doesn't, you know, for the sake of a sentence or a footnote or something, it's much easier to, better, I think, to give the reader that information there rather than have them be distracted and going and Googling it, and then they've kind of come out of the book, and that's my kind of view on that, really.
Yeah, I enjoy the footnotes in Ghostland. They're very useful. So I suppose there's still the same sort of necessity to pay attention and take care of delivering information and build up a little bit of suspense, maybe, so that the reader wants to move on in nonfiction, not be told everything in a great info dump, but they can wait for something.
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly tried to do that with Ghostland, and I guess I was writing Ghostland with a bit of a novelist sensibility still. I wasn't particularly doing anything in any different way. Nobody had taught me how to write a non-fiction book. I'd written one novel before, and I suppose I took the same lessons that I'd learned myself from that and applied them to the non-fiction book. So, yeah, I wanted people to want to know, well, that's a mystery there, what's this, or withhold little bits. And I definitely think you can apply some of those same kind of tactics, really.
So I mean, the narrator in your book is an omniscient viewpoint that takes people through, but there's no need for it to be absolutely a complete know-all and sort of ruin any drama developing or the interest in whatever you're writing about.
Yeah, well, I suppose in Ghostland, it's a first person book.
You're involved.
Obviously, I know the story. It's certainly the autobiographical story. Quite clearly, when you're writing it, there's a dichotomy there because you know yourself the things that are going to unfold. So there's a little bit of a duplicitous thing going on with the audience because you're presenting that stuff. And quite clearly, I could at the beginning of the book say in about three pages, well, this is the stuff that happened because I know it. But obviously, actually, within writing it as well, there was a slightly revelatory process as well that I was undergoing whilst doing it. But yeah, you're kind of, all these different things are in the mix that you're trying to deal with, and you're definitely having to think about. I didn't over obsess, and it's something I tell my students on this course to not over obsess too much about the reader, because there's no, in a way there's no such thing as a reader. There's lots of different readers
who
bring different things to it and get different things. So if you try and do too much to try and appeal to everyone, or you have this image of what they are, you're kind of on a bit of a hiding to nothing, because you can never really know what they want. You can never satisfy all of their different desires because they'll all be so disparate. So I suppose in that regard, I guess writing a book for me as the reader, really, and me as the audience, and to try and write a book that I would enjoy reading. So even though obviously part of it I knew, the big part of the story wasn't a surprise to me. So yeah, there's an imaginative leap within that that you have to take. But
and is that advice you give to your students, to imagine themselves as an interested, engaged reader, rather than the perfect reader or a room of 100 readers?
I would say write a book that
you want to read,
and then you've got to write a book that you're happy with and that you would want to keep turning the pages for. I mean, other people might disagree with that, and that's not the be all and end all. There's clearly, at some point, you have to have a little bit of thought as to, well, what would readers want to know here, or how you might make some guesses as to what they might want. But again, you can't really kind of satisfy all of those kind of needs. So you have to, the one reader you can appease is yourself, I suppose.
Right. You can satisfy that reader.
Yeah, so
but there must be, I suppose, a bit of a temptation to move into historical fiction. You know, I don't know if any of your students are interested in that. So, you research a great number of writers and very interesting stories that they wrote and why that came about. I mean, it'd be very easy to sort of slide away from completely factual nonfiction and start writing, a story based on some of that work.
Yeah, certainly for fiction, for me, I think at this point in time, if I was to write another novel, I would be more interested in it being, I wouldn't want it to be a contemporary novel, even if it was set 10 years or 20 years ago. I kind of like that little window of time, I think, and I'd be, I could see myself more going down that route rather than something that's set in 2020 or 2021. I'd probably rather be thinking of kind of pre-COVID days and a different thing. Or so, yeah.
I think somewhere in Ghostland you say, and I don't know which writer it was, but they said something like, it's right and proper that a ghostly tale is a few years in the past.
Yeah, it's a line from, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it's an M.R. James line about a haze of distance is desirable,
right,
30 years. And that was actually, that kind of became my modus operandi for Ghostland, in that I was, a lot of the events in that book for my own life were kind of looking back 30 years or so. So I was doing a similar thing, actually. Looking back to those events and trying to make sense of them and to see kind of what else then could emerge from that.
Now, I know that one of your influential books certainly has that haze of distance. It was set in the Victorian, just after the Victorian era, is that right? It was England's Lost Eden.
Yeah, so this was a book I'd read, I think I probably read it about a year before I started writing Ghostland. It's a book by Philip Hoare, who's one of my favourite non-fiction writers. The book that by him that most people would have first heard of would be Leviathan, which he won Samuel Johnson Prize for, which is a book about Moby Dick and really about whales and his response to all of that. It's a fantastic, huge, thick book and a book I really love. But off the back of reading that, I think the next one I read was England's Lost Eden, which is, it's a non-fiction book about the New Forest, which is somewhere that I also write about in Ghostland, and it's somewhere that's got quite a kind of connection to me, because we went there on a quite an early family holiday, and my brother used to live not far from there, so it was somewhere I'd been to a lot, so it was a place that I was reasonably familiar with, but always seemed a bit mysterious, and also kind of had slightly kind of romanticized connotations in my head, I suppose, because I was looking back through that haze of distance to earlier visits, you know, on family trips and things. But it's a book about that sort of 19th century, towards the end of it, all these religious sects and cults that kind of emerge, with people kind of prophesizing the end of the world and salvation. And then there's all stuff about spiritualism and Conan Doyle, who I write about in Ghostland, in that New Forest chapter. He had a holiday home there, and lots of his sort of seances were taking place there. That's sort of mentioned quite briefly in Philip's book, but there's other kind of figures. There's the art critic Ruskin. There's just all these different disparate people were drawn there, and he really magically weaves their stories, I think. And I suppose that was a little bit of a model for when I then came to, when the prospect of Ghostland came along. Well, I was thinking, well, if I was to write a narrative non-fiction book, what's the sort of book, what's the kind of, you know, the writers I like? And that was one of the books that I was thinking of, and thinking, well, you know, this is the sort of book I'd like to try and do my best to write something like this, or, you know, take some inspiration from. So
I mean, that's good advice, to have something in mind, something tangible you can sort of aim towards. You're not going to copy it, but it's going to be a useful signpost.
Well, you certainly need to. I mean, that's one of the other things that when you're teaching creative writing, that you end up, you know, one of the other big bits of advice is just to read a lot. And whether that's
always.
And one thing I always say is, you know, it doesn't have to be books that are necessarily like the book that you're working on yourself. I mean, there's lots of books that are probably a lot closer to my book. You know, there's books that people have sort of made comparisons with Ghostland, which I can see the comparison, but they're not books I've read. So when people kind of imply, oh, you've probably read, you know, one that kind of people say that there's some similarities, and I can see that there's thematic similarities between my book and Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk, which is a book that's on my bookshelves, but I've still never got round to reading, because I think when Ghostland got commissioned, I didn't want to read it because I didn't want to read a book that was perhaps tackling some similar themes, and then to feel that I was being derivative anyway. So it's still a book I've not. I will read it because it's obviously meant to be a beautiful book, and I will get around to reading it one day. And now I think I can, but. Yeah, so
yeah, that's a good point. I've had that when you're writing something and you find a book that's going to be a bit similar, and you think, no, I can't read it. It'll just spoil it for me.
Exactly.
It'll influence me somehow, and that's not what we want.
And actually, I also think that, you know, if you're writing a non-fiction book, you shouldn't just read non-fiction. You should. Yeah. Read novels as well, because that might tell you some interesting structural things that you might be able to do with your book, or just the language of it might kind of somehow kind of, you know, weave its magic on you. All these different things. And again, with Ghostland, there's certainly some of my another quite unlikely book that's been one of my favourite books since being a teenager, is Kurt Vonnegut's wonderful anti-war novel Slaughterhouse-Five.
A terrific book, yeah.
I mean, in many ways, Ghostland bears no resemblance to it, so the kind of crazy structure of Vonnegut's postmodern masterpiece doesn't really, you know, I don't do anything like that in my book at all, but I suppose I still, and actually my book's a book about all these kind of Victorian ghosts and Edwardian ghost stories and that kind of era, ostensibly, but I still did manage to weirdly mention Slaughterhouse-Five and bring a little bit about that because of its resonance on my own past. But so yeah, that's I suppose an unlikely book that fed into my writing, that you wouldn't have picked that as being a book that would have.
No, right. So you, obviously not a direct influence, but a fantastic book, and the flow and the humour and the you know, the dark subject matter, amazing.
I think the overall thing that for me comes from it is Vonnegut's kind of humanity and warmth, really. And that's the thing that, even though he was personally in the he was someone on the ground in Dresden when it was firebombed in the Second World War, and witnessed that awful destruction, which I'm sure took him so long to process that it wasn't until towards the end of the 60s that he wrote that book. But even so, his kind of humanity, I think, kind of shines through from it. So that's another thing that I take from all of his writing.
Yes, it's this sort of bewilderment, isn't it? That I was just having a little look at it, and he said he wrote to the Air Force and said, what did you achieve with Dresden? How many planes went over? And, you know, what was the outcome? And they said, oh, it's still a secret. And he said, a secret from whom?
Yeah, he's certainly an author that, you know, you would wish is around today in these crazy times, I think.
Yeah, quite right. He put a few people straight.
Yeah.
Did you want to say something about another book that you found to have been influential?
Well, I can briefly. So another book that was a book I studied at A-level at school was William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, which is another modernist book. I think he wrote it in 1929 in about 6 weeks whilst he was doing night shifts at a local power station. And at the time, it was the first book I suppose that I'd read that was told from all these different multiple first-person perspectives. So the story unfolds with all these different characters telling you it, but in such a fragmentary form, because they're only kind of aware of these little bits that they've experienced or seen themselves. So there's a bit of kind of detective work of the reader, because you have to work quite hard as a reader. And I suppose we were doing it as A-level, and we had a good teacher who was explaining a lot of it and probably kept our interest. But it was a book that really stayed with me, and when I wrote my first novel, The Listeners, I absolutely, that is something that I did borrow from that structure, because I knew that I wanted to tell the story I was going to tell, but using that device of having these different characters who have only seen only aware of certain bits of the picture, and they then kind of retell it to you. So that was certainly an influence on that. I mean, it's a book that's, you know, I'm not the first author to be influenced by it, because I think Graham Swift's Last Orders, which won the Booker Prize, he also kind of very much borrows from the same structure from it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are great many narrators, and I was thinking this is something that would be very good to do as an exercise to find your story.
Yeah.
To ask all the characters you've dreamt up, and some of them might be as two-dimensional as cardboard, to say, well, what did you hear? You know, what did you think about this or see or do, and how do you know X from Y and all the rest of it? So it sounds something like the Alipo would do. You know, the constraint of they did that, didn't they? Someone did that. They told the scene from multiple viewpoints, the same scene, many, many times, and got a little bit of light on it, a different light on it each.
It's quite a filmic thing as well. I mean, there's lots of things do a similar thing. And I suppose, I guess when I first read it, I'd probably seen, because I was quite a film buff, I'd probably seen a few films where I kind of recognised that same thing going on, and that would have also been one of the things that attracted me to it, I think.
Right, yeah, that fragmentation and building the world.
Yeah.
In a very realistic manner as well. You don't have the omniscient sort of puppet master.
No, you're completely in the head of those characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've all got quite different voices as well, and that's quite appealing as a reader, at least to me, in that, you're getting kind of, they're not, if you're getting a bit tired of a certain character, then you know, well, actually, there's only another 10 pages, and then I'll be on to this next character who I really like. And there's an element of that actually, as a reader, it kind of can, it perhaps doesn't work for everyone, but I quite enjoy that it breaks up the reading experience a little bit.
Yes. And I mean, again, it'll help you find who is your main character, if you want to just have one or two or three, or maybe just the one. I mean, who's got the most to say? Who can carry the story?
Yeah,
and it might not be who you originally think. It might be somebody else.
No, and there's this strange thing that goes on. And in Faulkner's novel, there's one chapter that is, to cut a long story short, it's essentially a book about where this dirt poor family in the American Deep South, in the build up to the Depression. Their mother's died, and they are taking her body back to her hometown. That's quite a journey by horseback to bury her, and various things go wrong en route.
Yeah,
but kind of also, so within that though, there is a chapter where you hear from the dead woman, and she has a chapter where she narrates it, which is a device I really liked. And I was half tempted in my book, where there's a similarly unpresent figure, although the father in my book, John Abrahart's, died a year before the events have taken place, and he's a figure who really kind of, he dominates, but I decided in the end not to give him any chapters. I mean, I couldn't think of a way of doing it that wouldn't seem too contrived, but actually, even though you don't hear anything directly from it, I'd like to think that he's kind of striding through the background of the whole novel, and kind of in a sense he's one of the main characters in it, really, him and his son.
Yeah,
even though you never hear from him, but that was quite an interesting thing to...
That's remarkable.
Whilst I was writing it, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, that's a great range of inspiration there, from non-fiction to fiction, and all about the art of it. Fascinating stuff. I think your students are very lucky to have you.
I'm not so sure, but anyway, thank you.
Cheers, Ed. Thank you very much.
That's the end of Series 2 of The Joy of Writing. My thanks to all my guests for their insight into how a writer works and thinks, and how they got where they are and where they are going. The next series will feature a recap of what we have learnt so far, so stay tuned for the next series of The Joy of Writing.